This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy. On tonight's show, Greta Anderson, reporter for KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa, and Mark Edwards, who's retired from the Iowa Division of Natural Resources and is a current environmental activist. They're going to be on the program tonight via phone to let us know about the struggles against the pipeline in Iowa. So that's all coming up. But first, we've got a few headlines. I want to thank Natural E for compiling them, but she's under the weather, so I'll be reading them. On Saturday, over 100 people who call themselves protectors, not protesters, were arrested at a peaceful march after they were confronted by police in riot gear carrying assault rifles. They say police pepper sprayed them and arrested them en masse and discharged rubber bullets to shoot down drones the water protectors were using to document the police activity. And this was from Democracy Now!, and this was out at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Also, EcoWatch is reporting that the Muskrat Falls project, part of the $8.6 billion Lower Churchill hydroelectric project in Labrador, Canada, will flood the Lake Melville River Valley, which has cultural and spiritual significance for the Innu and Inuit peoples. Construction of the Muskrat Falls generation facility began in 2013, and sources say flooding may have already begun. Opposition to this project has been longstanding. Ozzy Mikkelin, a freelance journalist living in Labrador, has been documenting the fight against the dam. He shared how the hydroelectric project will, quote, cut through the unceded territory of the Nunakavut Inuit, the only group of Inuit in Canada with an outstanding land claim, and, quote, destroy hundreds of kilometers of forest and contaminate fish and seal stocks with methyl mercury, close quote. And that's it for our headlines this evening. And right, we're going to go right to the bulk of the program. And so let's do that right now. On the line with me, we have Greta Anderson, reporter for KHOI Community Radio, which is part of the Pacifica Network, our sister community radio station just up the road a piece on I-35 in Ames, Iowa. And they've been on the air for 4 years. And she has in the studio with her a guest. Greta, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hello, Mike.
Hi, you sound crystal clear.
Great. Yes, with me is Mark Edwards. He's retired from the Department of Natural Resources. That's our state EPA-type organization. He was a grant writer, planner, and coordinator there, as well as the trails coordinator. He built trails and maintained trails, and that's actually part of the story that we'll get to, Mark's experience going through all the permitting process of building a trail. Mark has also been very active throughout the pipeline struggle, but also in other water issues. Now, people have heard a lot, especially if they've been tuned into Pacifica Radio, to about the Standing Rock actions, of the historic Standing Rock actions, where people are standing up to protect the water up there, the Missouri River. Down here in Iowa, we've got a whole lot of rivers that are throughout the state, and we've been working very hard to protect them, too. And dozens, if not, you know, over 100 folks down here in Iowa have gotten arrested trying to stop or slow down the pipeline construction. So, you know, just a little bit of background about Iowa. I mentioned all the rivers. Mm-hmm. This proposal for a pipeline comes in the context of what can easily be called and has been called, a crisis in water quality in Iowa. We have hundreds of impaired streams and rivers. each year that list grows. Of course, it is directly attributable to our agricultural economy. So our very diminished Department of Natural Resources, and Mark was there to see the thing wither away, routinely documents when it still has stations nitrate levels from farming far in excess of the federal limit of 10 points per million for drinking water. But this is an organization that exists for the farmers and the hunters, not for the environment. You have to realize that Farm Bureau just runs this state in Iowa. And then a highly politicized, highly controversial focus from the federal government on Iowa to reduce the nutrients that it sends downstream into the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Excuse me. The outcome was a voluntary nutrient reduction strategy that has done little to nothing to improve nitrate levels from farming. They just keep getting worse as more farmers pull land out of conservation programs and back into production so that we can fuel the world and fuel the hogs of the world. So in the same summer that the pipeline was announced, the Des Moines Water Works, which draws its water from the surface of two rivers in the state, the Des Moines and the Raccoon, and serves over a million customers, announced that it was suing three upstream counties in a historic lawsuit that tries to reconceive the water coming off of the farm fields, or rather down through the first 4 feet of soil, percolating down then sideways, fast, through the extensive tile system into streams and rivers, to reconceive these outlet tiles, which can be like a foot around in diameter, as point sources of pollution rather than the non-regulatable, non-point source that farmland always has been. And the reason, of course, is that the Des Moines Water Works and its customers have to purchase more in the way of a nitrate removal system. Des Moines already has the world's largest nitrate removal system in the world, but it's looking at the fact that it has to invest hundreds of millions more in a new system. So that's kind of the whole picture of water. And now you think about Des Moines and its wealth and its size of its customer base. But then you've got a little town like Boone, Iowa. This is where Mark Edwards, my guest, is from. And it's got a population of 13,000, and they also get their drinking water from the surface, or very close to the surface, right?
That's right, yes. And, you know, I worked through my job in the natural resources. I worked with water trails, and so we did volunteer water monitoring groups, and so I got a broad-based education as our water has been deteriorating. And so, like in 2004, we had 313 impaired waterways that didn't make the federal guidelines. And by 2014, we have 725. So this is rapidly increasing. And so we're seeing this when we get down to the town's drinking water. We have 260 towns just on this Des Moines River watershed that get their drinking water from that river. And so that's 30% of the state's 60 towns are battling over high levels of nitrates and have no systems that can afford to put in a system to take the nitrates out. So it's becoming quite clear that we don't really have any way to kind of deal with this. The way Boone gets out of the problem temporarily at times is that they mix in various shallow well waters to dilute. So we all heard the discussion, you know, dilution is the solution to pollution. And so that gets you by at times, but the concentration of this nitrogen phosphorus is increasing all the time. So it's something that isn't going to be solvable quite easy at all. In fact, we have some figures that are saying just to cut the cost of that nitrogen phosphorus down, it's estimated to cost $1.2 billion annually, and that's over 5 decades. So it's a monumental problem.
And it's a problem, you know, recreational waters as well. You know, half of our beaches at least every weekend in the summer are closed. People cannot use those resources. And yet the state just recently relaxed the hog confinement site rules so that they don't have to be as far from the water as they used to be. It's kind of insane. We've got industry insiders on all of our environmental protection commissions. We have a Republican governor, a Republican Congress, and there's a risk that in this election our Iowa Senate is going to go Republican as well. So we're pretty scared around here, and it's not looking like we're going to make much progress. So in the meantime, the pipeline company comes along. We see this headline in the paper one day, and it shows a map of Iowa with a diagonal line across it from northwest to southeast. And, of course, that's the worst possible kind of orientation for farmers because they plow in straight lines and turn at 90-degree angles, and that's how our geography is laid out, much more so than in Missouri. You can get from A to B much faster in Iowa because it's just a straight shot, whereas Missouri, you've got all those winding roads and stuff. But so, and we hear from them, you know, oh, yeah, they'll go through all that public approval stuff, but, you know, they'll appear at your county courthouse or whatever. But before anyone knows it, they've already purchased or coerced farmers into selling them easements. And, by the way, the pipe is already on order. They've already paid for it. It just has to arrive. So we had, I guess, in November and December of last year, at least a dozen, probably more, 20 maybe, full-day hearings in front of this body that's going to decide whether or not the pipeline gets a permit. And this body is called the Iowa Utility Board. Made up of three people appointed by the governor. You can just imagine who those three people look like in terms of their ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Edwards, this valiant person next to me, was at nearly all of those hearings, if not
all. I'm not sure how valiant or how stupid it was to sit through it all.
You were a witness. And so he can tell you a little bit about them.
Well, as she said, it's three political appointed people in there. Actually, there was one woman that was on there before, and they were unsure quite how she was going to vote, so they took her off and replaced her.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's just been so obvious of the thing. And so all the utilities board had to decide was whether this met the convenience and necessity rule. And they said that this pipeline did, even though we don't get one drop of oil out of that pipeline. There's no spigot on the side here for our cars as it goes through the state. So
it's a question of whether this thing is a utility.
Yes.
The pipeline a utility? Because we got lots of pipes going through through our neighborhoods, and they are part of a utility system. They deliver our natural gas to our water heaters and so forth. But this is something different.
Yeah, and the utilities board is has no background for this kind of thing. This is the first kind of pipeline ever in the state of Iowa like this, especially this size and carrying this toxic crude. So a lot of questions have come up related to that. And what the first thing we saw with the board's thing is that the pipeline is only looked at in small segments, so it gets out of larger federal oversight. So they actually say for the oversight, the umbrella organization is the Iowa Corps of Engineers. And that now oversees only 2.7% of that pipeline in Iowa, and that's because it goes through either state lands or under our major rivers. So Iowa, we have the Missouri border on one side. We have the Mississippi River on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And as Greta said, we have this diagonal river, the Des Moines River, that drains two-thirds of the state from corner to corner, and that pipeline is parallel to that river and follows that river. So if there is a leak, it's going to end up in that Des Moines River watershed, which is going to dump right into the Mississippi River. So it's going to affect lots and lots of people. And as she mentioned, we have Des Moines, our capital city, which is 500,000 people just downstream a few miles from where this is crossing the Des Moines River. So as that raised concerns about the water and stuff, we wanted to know, well, what are we looking at here? And at the lowest pumping rate that they're talking, we're looking at 1 million gallons of toxic crude per hour coming out of that pipe.
Wow.
And when they get up to full production, it'll even be more than that. So a spill of 1 million gallons, we have one example so far in the country that I just pulled off, and it was the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. And that was looking, I think, at $3 billion cleanup. And
wow.
So when we started saying, well, what's your insurance? How are you going to cover this? Because the state rule only required $250,000 of liability insurance.
$250,000.
Wouldn't pay for the people to go out and look at the spill.
Wow.
So as we started negotiating with the company and we wanted them to put up some money, finally, we got it up to $25 million, but that's still, they don't have the assets even for $25 million. The pipeline company only is building the pipeline. This is the first time this company has ever built a pipeline. I mean, so as you get into the absurdities of this, more and more and more, it sounds like some comedy routine that this could ever get to this position. So every time we've come up with something to try to address the issue through every means possible, lawsuits go on and on. We have two main focuses. One is eminent domain, where they're coming in, and because it's declaring the pipeline as a public utility, they can now condemn and take personal property. And then the other issue is the oversight that they're going to be seen on here. And this is where my background came in. I immediately realized there was a problem before I even understood all this process, because I was the trails coordinator for the state. If I want to move a trail 12 feet over in a state park or on state land, or I want to build a new bicycle trail, I have to go through all these steps, and it takes me a good 3-4 years to get that trail built. I have to start with the Department of Transportation. I have to go to the Historic Preservation Office. I have to work with all the different federal regulations, all the Army Corps of Engineers, all this. And one of the first things I have to do is contact all the native tribes. So to put this in perspective, what's going up at North Dakota, at Standing Rock, is they're saying they never even came and contacted us. So they originally had the pipeline coming through Bismarck, North Dakota, the large, probably predominantly white city, and decided that was maybe a little unsafe to have it that close to a big city. So they moved it over right along the edge of the Indian reservation, and that's what has triggered this whole response up there. And so they didn't even contact the tribes, which is federal law. So if I have to do that to move a trail or build a bicycle trail, I couldn't understand how they got out of going through all this federal law. And that's the contention that the Standing Rock Sioux, and actually it's now 300 tribes, federally recognized tribes, have all agreed that federal law was not even followed.
And as far as the landowners, you know, the IUB approved the pipeline back in the spring. Landowner lawsuit was immediately filed. It has yet to be heard, but you know they're saying that the IUB made an error, you know, to declare this pipeline a utility when it's only serving profit interest, is not serving, as Mark said, any local interest. Although I guess if the fact that we drive cars and we might eventually get some of that that crude, although. You know, the word is that it's all going to be exported down to New Orleans and out.
That was the funny part, too. When they first were arguing all this, they were saying all the benefits that were coming to Iowa, and they said that the soil will come back to Iowa. Well, right after this thing got approved, the federal law was changed, and the federal law now allows you to pump all unprocessed toxic crude directly overseas without refining it. So now the country, the United States, isn't even going to get the refining profits. It's going to go directly overseas unrefined.
And of course, you know, as in so many cases, they pit labor against environment, environmental causes. So a huge element of this, these hearings in November and December were the pipe fitters of Iowa, or actually I think a lot of them came from outside of Iowa.
Yeah, we've been looking into that.
How many jobs they're going to create out of this?
I think we're down to, at first they were saying these vast numbers, and we still have got no data. We can't get anyone to justify any of the data that they throw at us, but they're saying we hardly ever see an Iowa plate out there working. They're all out-of-state plates, and every time I talk to any of the construction people, they're from out-of-state, and it's just a joke, because in the end we're talking 4 to 8 permanent jobs in Iowa. And the 2,000 to 4,000 that they're claiming of temporary summer job for a couple months, you know, even those are the guys doing the least jobs. You know, they're not getting paid the most. They're the people, the locals, are just the cleanup crew.
But these out-of-town workers, this is an amazing little fact that came to us from our local newspaper. The workers from out-of-state, because they are homeless, they qualify for the generous assistance of our local food bank. And so our food banks have been running dry because these workers from out of state, taking the jobs that were promised to Iowans, you know, in exchange for this pipeline deal, they're eating all of the food for our homeless, too.
Wow.
It just gets better and better. If it weren't so Horrid.
Yeah, they talked about we were going to get $16 million in property taxes for Iowa. So that's really way less than 1% of the pipeline's thing. And so when you look at this, that's the pipeline is pumping $12.5 billion worth of oil through there a year. So, 1% is nothing compared to what we're supposed to get in return for allowing this pipeline company to go through Iowa.
That's incredible. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a couple minutes with Greta Anderson and Mark Edwards. We're talking about it's the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's the same pipeline, right?
Yep.
In Iowa, and we'll find out. I want to find out about the protest, the Farm Progress show, and much more. So we'll be right back.
Thanks, Mike.
Yep.
Ari Berman on rigged elections and Dean Baker on debt and entitlements. On Counterspin, Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. After the Harvest, a nonprofit volunteer hunger relief organization, is looking for volunteers to help pick fruits and vegetables to feed people in need. Call 816-921-1903 or go to our website, aftertheharvestkc.org, for more information. This message, a public service of 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 6-year-old Mars Engel Dixon may be the youngest climate change activist in America.
Well, the atmosphere is the blanket, actually, and it traps all those greenhouse gases, methane, carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere.
Kids today are growing up in a time when climate change is affecting their health and environment. Mars has been concerned about the issue since preschool. Talking about problems like air pollution and habitat loss can be tough at any age. But instead of feeling frightened or powerless, Mars has chosen to share his concerns with his congressman and other kids.
Hey, please, can you listen to me, friend? You know I really care about the environment.
Once, to get his friends engaged, he gave away composting worms at his birthday party. Mars knows worms help improve soil, so it can better store carbon. Mars says he wants to be an engineer when he grows up, so that he can invent new ways to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. But he's just 6 years old, so he thinks that maybe fairies could help too. Imaginative? Yes. But multiplied in schools across the country, his can-do spirit spells new hope for the fight against climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, here we are back in Eco Radio KC. This is Mike Murphy. I've got Greta Anderson and Mark Edwards on the phone from Iowa. And first of all, if I haven't already, folks, thanks for taking the time to do this. I know you guys are real busy, so it's great that you can take the time and update our listeners.
Oh, we love sharing the story.
Yeah, as more people learn, they sure get scared. And the polls have shown that it's really turned here in Iowa considerably against the pipeline once the information's gotten out.
Really?
Yeah. Well, so around midsummer this past summer, you know, there was just this feeling like something has got to be done. We had a bunch of landowners whose land had been seized. They, like I said, established a lawsuit. But that wasn't really going anywhere, and yet the pipeline was being laid, and trees were being cut down, and we just saw all this progress. Something has to be done. So Mark here helped to organize, along with an organization called Bold Nebraska, which is sort of Bold Iowa, excuse me, which is adjunct to Bold Nebraska, which led the effort against the Keystone Pipeline. And then we have Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, which is a grassroots organization with a long history of speaking for citizens, opposing hog confinements, and so forth. So all these people got together, organized the first protest at which people got arrested, in which some headlines were made. They blocked the entryways to the central Iowa stockyard where they kept the pipeline company was keeping, would park their trucks at in the evening, get them in the morning, where some materials were stored, and so forth. So So there were four different entrances, and people stood in front of them. And eventually the trucks with out-of-state plates showed up and, you know, needed to get into the yard. And then the sheriff, you know, informed the people who had been, you know, well-trained in how to do this. Well, if you do not move, then you will be arrested. And so it went. I think about 40 people got arrested that first go-round.
Right. And ironically, it was right across the road from the Farm Progress Show, which is thousands of people. I mean, it's a really big thing of all the new equipment, and people come from all over the Midwest to come to this. So it was trying to point out, and in the farming community and I was somewhat divided because they were shocked over the eminent domain that, you know, you could come in and take property for something that they don't understand as being a public utility.
Right.
And so at the same time, you know, farmers in Iowa are kind of going on about their business, moving towards their harvest, and so if it didn't directly affect them, you know, they didn't really understand what was going on, and that was true pretty much of the populace in Iowa. Everything has had no pipeline has ever happened this fast. And so that's been the biggest thing, is just getting the word out so that people understand what's going on. And then as we've worked our way through, we understand that this really is the Keystone replacement. They have the pipeline going north on up to the Canadian border. The Energy Transfer Company, which is the parent company of the pipeline, has 49% of their backing, financial backing, is now coming from Enbridge, which is the Canadian oil company. Mm. So everything is getting lined up. This is their replacement for the Keystone pipeline. It's coming in the back door. And they can do it because they're only looking at little segments in the United States. They're not looking at the full length of the pipeline from Canada going all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And
right.
That's how they got around it.
The fact that the Keystone was international pipeline, that required action on the federal level. That's why Obama could veto it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no such barrier now. Now it's just state by state, and each state is as corrupt as the next, you know. And Iowa is among the best of them in that department.
Well, Iowa, on the local level, I mean, getting back to the protest, I mean, you know, we're Iowa nice here. We're not used to this kind of stuff, you know. And so to see 200 people just keep showing up in the middle of the work week to protest this thing, and then 30 people get arrested here, or 20 here, or 16 here, you know, and then we're kind of realizing, you know, we're really just handing them the fine money. We're just kind of going through, like, it's like a play. The law enforcement's there. And then Dakota Access has their own security force from out of state. And so as we get arrested, you know, you just go pay your fine and you get out of there. So we've kind of been trying to play with different techniques of how to address this. So the last time we did, we just parked all our cars and got out, left our cars. So we got moving violations on the cars, and those fines were a lot cheaper than getting arrested for trespassing. And so It's been an interesting little play going on here of how do you raise public awareness of what's going on, and we were doing that through arrest, and that's too bad that that's what it's come to. But we've had a total, pretty much media blockout because the discussion, as Greta mentioned earlier, has always come down to, like, we're trying to fight with the workers and try to keep them from working. And I found it interesting. I come from a construction background, so I was talking to the workers, and they've got problems with that company, too. You know, they've got lawsuits against their unsafe practices. They've killed a few of them working on the pipeline here. I mean, it's just there's other aspects of this that you learn that the pipeline workers are just trying to make a living, too, and this is the only choice they have. So that's kind of a sad situation to me, that you can only get temporary jobs.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I would listen to National Public Radio the day after this first series of arrests across from the Farm Progress Show. Great symbolic action that could, you know, have been a very rich story. And our Iowa Public Radio reporter, who, you know, submitted the story to National Public Radio, they made it just seem like, you know, oh, these, you know, not in my backyard. Yeah, that's all it was. It's just parochial interest. Whereas, you know, obviously, there's so much more. You know, speaking also of protests, something happened really interesting in Boone County, where Mark is from, a little bit earlier, and this was, you know, symbolic or exemplary of the divide and conquer kind of strategy. You know, along with the state approval, there was also an opportunity for counties to weigh in. Each county, and every single county along the path of this pipeline agreed to, you know, rolled over and said, "Oh, I can't, you know, I don't have the authority. I can't do it." Well, Boone County, where Mark lives, and a lot of other great activists, and which is really, it's like an emerald county. It's just the recreational gem of Iowa.
The reason for that, we've been working for years with our board of supervisors on local, trying to address these nitrate problems, because we know that Boone can't afford to build a nitrate removal system for millions and millions of dollars. We couldn't afford to do that. So we've got to figure out how to address so we could have drinking water. And so we've already been working with the supervisors. So they understood kind of what was up here to lose. And so we got them to pass a resolution and to not allow eminent domain. That was the way we were going to stop the pipeline from coming through the county. Well, then the state comes down, the politics come down to the county attorney, and he tells the Board of Supervisors, well, you can't pass a law saying you can't do it. It came out even stronger. And then the state came down on us and said, no, you can't do it. We'll sue you if you take local control to try and stop this pipeline. And that's what really is sad, because you can't go to your local level and address the needs and get questions even answered. And you can't go to your state level. And the federal people are not even weighing in. And this is really what's sad, because it's law. You know, I've lost the faith in the government. And I gave my life. I tried working in the system 30 years in that Department of Natural Resources to address these kinds of issues. And I'm seeing we can't even make sure that we're going to get drinking water. And now we've got a pipeline which should come in and take away. I mean, if we have a leak in that Des Moines water system, you know, the city of Des Moines, 500,000 people are going to be drinking bottled water. How long are you going to do that, not take a shower? You know, Boone is not going to have any water. The town will have to get up and move because there's no other alternative for our drinking water.
And you really have to imagine in your mind the beauty of this river that we're talking about, the Des Moines River. It's so deeply cut. You know, Iowa is generally a flatland, but you get over to Boone and you get to the Boone County, and the Des Moines River is just a beauty.
That's right.
It's so steep. And so what the pipeline does, it goes under the river.
That's how they got around a lot of the oversight and permitting. And that's how they got around some of the Indian burial sites, too. They just said, well, just drill underneath them. We won't disturb them. And, you know, they figured out, as one of the vice president of Dakota Access Transfer Partners testified, even that, you know, we learned with Keystone how to do this. We're not going to make the same mistakes we made with Keystone. We're going to break this up into little pieces. And they knew this is like a game for them. They're just going through it. And they've never stopped. And the whole provision with the IUB, the Iowa Utilities Board, was you cannot begin construction until you have all your permits. They still do not have their permits. They begin cutting trees and doing all the infrastructure, electrical substations, everything, and they didn't even have the permit yet. And so when they got called on it, then they just stopped for a while, and they cut the trees so that they wouldn't be able to find any Indiana bats, which is a federal endangered species. I mean, they just keep going against every rule that's placed in front of them. And that's what really, like I say, the hardest thing of this is it's taken all your faith away from government. I mean, it's a rigged game. There's just no other way to look at this.
One of the regulations in the IUB ruling is that the company can't be out on the land, on the farmland, if the conditions are so wet that a farmer in a tractor would not be out on the land. And we, in September, had just a very rainy month, over and over again, downpours. Maybe you got them, too, down there in Missouri. But there were any number of days when that rule would apply, and yet people were seeing the pipeline, the companies, and the big machinery out there on the land just destroying that structure that of soil that is, you know, so vital and precious and unique to where we live.
Well, the last little media attention we got was there. We were arresting landowners that were out on their own property trying to get to oversee what was being done. And that's been the other hard part of this, is the landowners sign this agreement and think that they're going to be able to go out there and make sure the job's being done right. And then they're not allowed on site because of safety concerns with that heavy machinery running. So then they have to have training. They have to go and get some of them go and get training. And then they're still not being allowed out there. So then they arrested one of the women landowners here the other day for trespassing on her own property.
Cindy Coppola of Calhoun County.
I heard that. Yeah, that was on Democracy Now, actually, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Well, that's incredible. So all in all, in Iowa, how many people have been arrested?
I think we're up to 140-something now. And we, like I say, we kind of learned pretty quick what's the point of getting arrested. You know, we were talking about how do you stop the pipeline. So it went to, like at the Mississippi Stand, which is down in the southwest corner of Iowa, where it's crossing the Mississippi, people decided to go a little, take different tactics, and they've been locking up to the machinery. Individuals. So individuals have been taking a bigger hit or responsibility, and the fines have been bigger because it wasn't doing us any good. We could have had a lot more people. We had 1,000-something registered to be arrested on the pledge of resistance, but it's such a rigged game. You just like paying them your fine, you know. It's like, why am I paying them to stand there and put my hands behind my back?
Is the pipeline being built through Iowa contiguously, or are they picking and choosing like the paths of least resistance?
It would have been cheaper for them to do that. But what they did is they immediately went and focused on the landowners that were fighting it in court, and they jumped and went and did their property first. So the person that led the charge and has formed the group of landowners fighting it in court, they went to his property first, and they did his first.
Wow.
I mean, they're bullies. There's no question. A lot of the people that signed the easement said, I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't have them harassing me, calling me 10 times a day. They would park at the end of my lane, and every time I'd want to go in and out, they would stop and talk to me about why I should sign this easement. It's just been really, you realize how unscrupulous these people are.
Could be because there's a lot of been arrests in Boone County, I think, and Calhoun County, as you mentioned. I think I also heard Keokuk, Iowa, the other day, which is at the easternmost point of the state, right? Southeastern.
Yeah, that's the Mississippi Stand that I was referring to, and that's where it's crossing the Mississippi. It comes out of Iowa in that corner. And so we tried to form something there. We've got a lot of support out of St. Louis. Some people have come from St. Louis and various other places. Mm-hmm. And a lot of action has happened there, you know. So they've got a permanent camp. It's been there for a month or so.
Oh, is that right?
So, yeah. And then we had them here in central Iowa, too. We've had great community support in the little town of Pilot Mound that we have the community center. They give it to us free. We have all our big trainings for civil disobedience, and we do big feeds and trying to just educate the local people about what's going on. Because, you know, most of us are pretty individualistic here in Iowa and rural. So, and that's the other part. That's why they took advantage of moving that pipeline from Bismarck, from a large city, over to the Indian reservation because there's less people. Well, they've done the same thing in Iowa. They made it very sure where they laid out that pipeline that it would avoid the major cities, it would avoid public land, so there wouldn't be any scrutiny. And Iowa's a rural state, and so they bought off the landowners individually. So we haven't had time to really do much organizing. I mean, this thing has come at us so fast. We never thought it would get this far. I mean, that's what I'm saying. From my DNR background, I can't ever believe this happened. I mean, that you don't even follow federal law is beyond my comprehension.
So, I mean, part of the game, you know, in the short term is to make sure there's no gas, crude flowing by winter, you know, that the pipe is not completed by winter because, of course, we'll have a freeze. They can't, you know. They can't drill through rock hard, although I don't know.
I'm not sure either.
Another issue is the finances of this company. Yeah. And we have a member of the coalition who's been very active in sort of, you know, ferreting out that information. But it doesn't really look good for Dakota Access, but they've got all these big banks behind them. So it's hard to say.
Well, and they've set it up. Dakota Access is actually just the company that just builds the pipeline. So they have no assets. They're just the builders of the pipeline. And they subcontract all the work out. So it's not even, that's why we were going after them on liability. You got to have more than $250,000 liability, you know. So, and as you get bigger, then the company that oversees the Bakken pipeline and the construction is the energy transfer companies. And then you've got, now they've sold out to Sunco, parts of them, 49% with Enbridge. You can't really keep up with the shell game because it's all working off of debt given by loans and banks. And that's what we keep saying. If we can just slow them down a little bit, there's a good chance they could go bankrupt on this deal, because if they can't keep getting banks to loan them more money, they're like millions and millions of dollars in debt already. So their deadline is to get this through, and they knew that right off the bat. They knew they had to get through it fast. That's why they pushed this through so fast. They haven't gone through the scrutiny that they should have gone through, even for a trail. I mean,
And in the meantime, the price of the crude has dropped, so that the potential value of what they're doing, it might all be, already sent off on a train somewhere by the time the pipeline gets finished. So that's another hope that, maybe we'll pump that sucker dry, although, of course, we want it to stay in the ground, but, the less economically attractive it becomes, the more chance that it will stop dead in its tracks.
Yeah, well, good point. So, Greta, you mentioned the election earlier, like elections coming up in Iowa. Is this an issue?
We went into their finances and we saw that they gave money to all the senators and the legislators. And I mean, everybody is getting money through this for the election. It's just terrifying. Directly from the company. I mean, they're not even trying to hide it hardly. So we think it hasn't even been discussed as an issue. Bernie Sanders is the only one, I think, on the national level that's come out with a stance on it. Locally,
I would say that our supervisor, we have supervisors who run our counties, a three-person supervisor board in most counties here in Iowa, and I would say that our local supervisor races have made some hay out of this, because our, the old boy network that has been in place here in Story County, they just rolled over and let the thing, just agree to everything, and we have a lot of challengers. A few challengers who are very vocal about being anti-pipeline, and they seem to be getting some traction. And we're kind of tired of this roll over and play dead thing, because we have the same thing with our hog confinement operations. The county supervisors kind of say, oh, it's out of my authority, I can't do anything. And, they could do a lot more than they are. And so, we're tired of it. We want somebody to stand up.
Because politics are getting so strange anyways. But, on the local level, it's been interesting, because you have the Trump people working with the Bernie people, because they're coming at it from different ends over eminent domain. Mm-hmm. So it's made the strangest of bedfellows. I mean, it's just been so funny, all the different people that come to these rallies. It's a complete mix. It's just been phenomenal. It's anything I've ever seen before. So it's not just environmental people, crazy environmentalists.
That's
young people and old people.
It's been really interesting. All of us getting outside our bubbles.
Well, that's good. Out of the silos. Yeah. Little cross pollination never hurt anyone.
What is the value? I mean, when we're getting down to water, I don't think it matters what political persuasion you have.
That's
you
got right.
to have a drink of water. So it's been real interesting.
All right, we're going to take another break, and we'll be back in just a little bit with Greta Anderson and Mark Edwards up in Iowa, talking about the pipeline there. We'll be right back.
Join us for this week's Heartland Labor Forum as we focus on some of the earliest victims of the U.S. War on Terror, Italian Americans. We will talk with a leading authority on the contributions of Italians to the Industrial Revolution in early 1900s America. Then, Peter Fleming, author of The Mythology of Work, How Capitalism Persists Despite Itself, says work used to be inextricably linked to survival and self-preservation. Now it's morphed into a painful and meaningless ritual colonizing almost every part of our lives. He'll explain this Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast. Friday, 5 a.m.
The Green Foundation, based in Karnataka, India, started by encouraging local seed saving and has built a network of women farmers who also process their own crops locally, a growing trend in opposition to multinational corporate ag. Hear this inspiring story on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Trading gray for green infrastructure. On this current cast. When it rains, it pours off pavement and into sewers and so-called gray infrastructure. This can overwhelm the system, sending pollutants past water treatment centers, straight into creeks and streams. So to absorb and filter stormwater where it falls, some cities are turning to green infrastructure, such as rain gardens.
The rain garden is designed to put a portion of that water back into the ground.
That's Andy Sansone of Monroe County Environmental Services in New York. He says the benefits of replacing pavement with plants go beyond water quality.
It gives us the ability to create some green spaces that weren't otherwise there.
Providing a solution that's beautiful and functional. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant. Online at currentcast.org.
And we're back here on Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We've just got a few minutes left, but Mike Murphy here with Greta Anderson and Mark Edwards. And we're talking about all things going on up in Iowa and how this is interconnected with the water and everything else. So welcome back. And again, I want to thank you guys for sticking with us and sharing the story. It's good that we do this.
Yeah, we should talk all the time.
Yeah.
Well, Kansas City gets their water out of the river, don't they? Out of the Missouri River.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So you guys are in the same boat with the rest of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Be careful what you guys do up there with that water. It's coming down here. Yeah. So, Greta, what kind of role is KHOI, the community radio station in Ames, played in this whole thing?
Well, we have a morning talk show that airs three times a week. Actually, we have three different shows, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but then each of those airs two more times. So, you know, we've got a lot of opportunity to hit listeners with information and perspectives that they might not have heard. We've been very pleased to be able to bring Mark and many, several of the other pipeline fighters, the water protectors, onto our show. It's been so surprising to meet people who, you know, you wouldn't know otherwise. And here's a young mother of, you know, five or something in Boone, Iowa, who's, you know, leading parades and you know, rallying people. And then, the wife of a railroad engineer who's, also joining her. And then, you know, a woman in Ames here who leads a coalition and submitted a lawsuit or a brief at this hearing on behalf of future generations. You know, that she was representing, as a lawyer, future generations. And she's also been up there to Standing Rock. In fact, a lot of these folks have been up to Standing Rock, and we enjoy getting their stories after they come back as well. So we feel like we've been very well connected due to the activism of the people around us. It's just been a real pleasure.
And I think that's been the surprising part, is the media coverage of this has been just terrible, just horrible. And this radio station has done the best coverage of all. In fact, some of the things that have come out on this radio station have been picked up and run by the AP because it's just not getting out. We can't quite understand that, except when you see how money flows and what goes into the newspaper and stuff, you've got to do something really kind of crazy, like get arrested, I guess, before you can get any press about really what's going on in the state.
So. Yeah, in the Des Moines Register, we see a lot of these stories where they recycle the same information about how long the pipeline is, where it's from, who's building it, all that, you know, stuff that takes up about two-thirds of the article, and then they might have a little couple paragraphs of news about it. So you don't have a chance for perspectives or conversation and deep thinking about it. And that's the great luxury that radio offers you. And we can spend a whole hour really delving into this stuff and thinking about it, talking about it. It makes a huge difference in just the consciousness of people.
Yeah. I'll vouch for that too. I know that's a great way. We believe very strongly in our community radio station here, so we're glad you folks have that opportunity. One striking thing between like Standing Rock and what's going on in Iowa, it's a native-led thing in Standing Rock. Is there a native presence in Iowa?
Absolutely.
With regard to this,
the Meskwaki Tama Fox heritage in Iowa, and they're one of the few tribes that came back taken off of their land, and then they came back and bought land in Iowa. But they still have their sacred sites and all that. They've written letters. The tribal council has stood up and said, you know, no one ever contacted us, which is, again, federal law. And then this is traditional Sioux territory also. So in the sites that I know, I'm living along the Des Moines River Valley, we know of numerous. There's hundreds of burial mounds alone along in that river. I talked to one of the neighbors the other day, and he said, yeah, 2 years ago they dug up bones across the river. Not quite exactly where this pipeline is, but we have had surveys done to find out what we have here. So, yeah, we have a lot of traditional people have come out of the woodwork. There's a new organization of indigenous people, a woman from over in Iowa City. We have 14,000 Native Americans living in Iowa, and they have just formed a whole new group over this issue. And that's been the inspiring part about Standing Rock. They've come down here numerous times to work with us, and we've gone up there. And the relationship is just so good for all of us because we're looking at this on a different level. You know, you get so disappointed and sad looking at how the bureaucracy works. But when you look at how people work and how they're going, and like I say, the cross between political orientations and stuff. It's been so inspiring. It's just hard to describe how beautiful the experiences have been with people. It is spiritual.
That's inspiring for you to hear you say that. So before I let you go, like, what do you expect developments over the next couple of weeks? Anything?
That's a good question. Yeah, we're still discussing different tactics. Everyone's kind of, you know, fall. It's, I think, you know, when we looked at Standing Rock, for example, and they're talking water is life, and it's just a basic thing, and they're up there, just think of the thousands of people that have been up there, and there hasn't been any violence whatsoever, except on the Dakota Access security side of pepper spray and dogs attack. And that's what we're really trying to say is, you know, we're really upset about this, but we're not saying anything about violence. So who's violence? I go to the protest, and I go down by the river, and on one side of the fence is hundreds of people singing and dancing and chanting, and on the other side of the fence is 40, you know, highway patrol. There's 35 county sheriffs. There's 25 security from Dakota Access, people standing over there with dogs, all with heavy armor, guns, all kinds of calibers, body armor. I mean, I could go on. It just is absurd when you stand back and you look at each side of that fence, you know, and where is the violence coming from? Where is the violence? It's that machine tearing up that beautiful Iowa soil. It's that machine drilling under our water source. It's, you know, it's these law enforcement protecting that private company's right to profit off the public good.
Wow. That's a perfect note to leave the program on. So thank you so much, Mark, and thank you, Greta. Yeah. We appreciate you taking all this time with us, and this has been very helpful in helping us sort things out down here.
Well, thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah, and let's keep in touch and see what other information sharing we can be doing between our two stations.
I'd love that.
Okay, thanks, folks. We'll let you go, and we're going to go on to our calendar of events. And let's see. So we've got Kansas City Food Not Lawns, a couple community courses here. The first one's Food Not Lawns. Wednesdays starting October 26th, it's two sessions, the 26th and the 2nd, from 7 to 9 p.m., and that's at the UMKC School of Medicine, Theater C. And more information, you can contact our old comrade, Steve Mann. Steve at foodnotlawnskc.org is his email address for more information about that. And then also we've got the Kansas City Environmental Management Convention meeting. That's Wednesday, November 9th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Mid-America Regional Council, Rivergate Center, second floor, 600 Broadway. And then the Introduction to Urban Permaculture, also a community course. That's Wednesday, November 9th and 16th, two sessions, also at that UMKC School of Medicine Theater C. You can also check with Steve Man, Steve at foodnotlawnskc.org to find out more. We're going to go out with This Week in Water, and thanks again to our guests, and stay tuned for Fiesta Musical.
Colorado and California worry that this little girl will ruin the winter. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Dusty dirt roads, chapstick, and body lotion. The signs of dry conditions are apparent in parts of Colorado lately.
According to the U.S. agency that monitors precipitation, the Front Range is in a drought, and there are worries that the situation may become worse if the La Nina phenomenon causes less snowfall this season.
The current lack of precipitation from the South Denver metro area, north 100 miles nearly to Wyoming, is meteorological drought that comes from a deficit in rain or snowfall, and it's having a significant impact on the landscape.
A more severe drought, dubbed hydrological, occurs when low water supply becomes evident, and usually after many more months of dry conditions.
While the area is not in the more serious category, the La Nina weather phenomenon could develop in December and push the storm track north, leaving Colorado with less snow than is needed.
The good news in the heavily urbanized area is that reservoir levels are in good condition from last year's snowpack.
In California, the situation is still very serious. More than 40% of the state remains in exceptional or extreme drought conditions.
Weather forecasters are currently saying that the outlook is for above average temperatures around the Golden State, and La Nina could cause drier conditions.
But La Nina is fickle, as NOAA's Mark Halpert told SF Gate. He said that the outlook could change if she does not come back.
Water conservation efforts are waning in parts of the state. Mandatory restrictions were lifted earlier, and officials are concerned that use has gone up too much.
Peter Gleick of the Pacific Institute told the New York Times that it was a mistake to lift the required conservation targets because it took pressure off of utilities and individuals to be more efficient.
Some of this drought news contradicts what people in San Francisco have experienced. The city has received about twice the usual amount of rain since the 1st of October, with more expected this week.
In both Colorado and California, many precip prognosticators are closely watching what happens in the Rockies and the Sierras as snow season begins.
Last week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments in a groundwater case that's drawing attention from across the country.
The dispute came to a head 3 years ago when the Agua Caliente Native American Band sued two water providers, saying that they had reduced the quantity and quality of groundwater under the tribe's reservation.
Groundwater levels around Palm Springs, California have declined over the years as water has been pumped from the aquifer to expand subdivisions, golf courses, resorts, and farms, according to the Desert Sun.
In an attempt to replace the groundwater, the two providers used surface supplies from the Colorado River, but the tribe says the replacement water was saltier and less pure.
So the main question for the courts, does the tribe hold a right to groundwater beneath its land that dates back to 1876 when the federal government established the reservation?
A lower court agreed with the Native Americans, and then the providers filed the appeal that was argued last week.
If the judge's questions to the lawyers during that argument are of any indication of how they'll rule, it's looking pretty good for the Agua Caliente.
Judge Tallman told one of the lawyers for the water districts that the land is very arid and is worthless without water. In other words, it was, of course, the intent of the U.S. government when it set up the reservation that the groundwater would be a part of the Indians' rights.
Lawyers for the tribe argued that California's water law cannot trump the tribe's rights, and the U.S. government lawyers agreed.
The question is of national importance because other tribes across the country may assert the same position, that they have rights to groundwater much older than those set up by each state.
A decision from the Court of Appeals is expected in a few months, and it's very likely to be appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And in other water news related to Native Americans, more than 80 people were arrested at the Dakota Access Pipeline protest on Saturday, about 5 miles from where they have been camping for months.
300 protesters had assembled at a construction site in Morton County, North Dakota, and the sheriff's office said that they were on private property acting unlawfully.
In a statement, law enforcement said that the demonstrators tried to breach a police line to move forward towards construction equipment. At that point, officers used pepper spray.
The protests are aimed at halting an oil pipeline that members of the Standing Rock tribe and their many supporters say threatens their drinking water and sacred grounds.
The protest continues as thousands of people have traveled to the area where a Texas company is trying to complete the pipeline project.
And finally this week, the small island nation of Iceland has a wealth of dramatic landscapes, from lava fields and glaciers to a rugged coastline dotted with scenic bays and fjords.
But being a small volcanic rock in the North Atlantic has its drawbacks. They're a bit lacking on many basic goods, so they have to import them.
So the last thing you would expect a country near the Arctic Circle to need? Ice.
A new report says that Iceland imports ice for sale in grocery stores, despite a natural abundance, because the stuff from neighboring Norway is often cheaper.
This is a bit embarrassing for a country that has plenty of ice fields and received a perfect score of 100 for water quality by Yale University.
It also drew a chilly rebuke by a local biologist who told the Iceland Review Online that residents need to factor in the real cost of the ice. The ships that transport it emit greenhouse gases and have a huge carbon footprint.
In other words, she's hoping that people buy local and all of this becomes an isolated incident. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Looking for solutions to utility challenges? Get answers at AWWA's Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 30th through November 2nd. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocom.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.